And okay, we're recording. Got it. There we go. Click that blue button. Thank you for that acknowledgement. I couldn't hope to replicate that myself, so I won't even attempt to, because I'll also start choking up. But that's another story. Okay, so let's talk about our representation on the board. This is actually, for me anywhere, where this whole discussion started about 5 years ago, I think, when a colleague asked me to vote for them because they were standing for membership on the pension board. So one of our business colleagues was standing for one of the seats on the pension board. And I said, yes, of course, I'll vote for you. You're a finance faculty member. You'll be great on the pension board. And then waited for my voting package to arrive, and it never did. So I called up the pension office and said, so-and-so is getting elected. I want to vote for them. When's my package coming? And they said, oh, it's not. And I said, oh, why? And they said, because you're a teaching stream faculty member and you don't get to vote on the pension board. And you don't have a representative on the pension board either, is what I eventually found out. So I started looking into the pension plan materials and the trust agreements and things like that. And let's see if I can get my multiple screens here that I'm running around on. So the actual trust agreement for the pension board, and it's driven by the combination plans agreement, because the our plan, which is the money purchase plan, does not talk about voting people into the pension board because we don't have that right. So the combination plan specifies that there's 8 trustees, and 4 of those trustees are appointed by the university, and they're referred to as university trustees. And these are typically people that are, you know, in the finance area in the university, that kind of thing. So it makes a lot of sense. And then there's 4 people that are elected by and from, that's the wording, the members of the combination pension plan. So given that we're not members of the combination pension plan, we cannot vote, nor can we stand to be as a member trustee. And this is where my interest in the awareness of some of the differences between the two different pension plans really came out. I mean, as a finance accounting person myself, I've always known there's a difference between a defined contribution plan, which is our plan, money purchase, and a defined benefit plan, which is the combination plan, which is what the research stream has. But in part because of the difficulty in getting comparisons, didn't really realize how big the differences were, but they do sort of start off with this representation. So as a result, the money purchase plan members, us, cannot stand for election, nor can money purchase plan members vote for anyone that's in that board of trustee grouping. So even though this board of trustees makes decisions around both pension plans, none of them are specifically from our pension plan, and nor do we get to vote. Now, whenever this has been raised at a pension plan meeting, the annual general meeting, the discussion always is, well, but the representatives represent everybody. And I'm sure that they do try to. But the reality is that if you're a combination pension plan member, you really don't have any skin in the game for the money purchase plan. It just really doesn't relate to you at all. And I think the fact that we do have such 2 dramatically different plans kind of speaks to that. So there's 4 seats available for election to the board. And if we just look at the numbers of faculty, so this, and I think Lynn or Sarah can correct me, I believe this came from HR in terms of the numbers of people that we have. In terms of what we call the teaching stream, there's 121 active faculty there. And in terms of the research stream, 718 active faculty there. And yes, thank you, Sarah, that's from HR. So we can see that the teaching stream is a significant number of people in total. One other thing to note here, and I'm not gonna address this myself, but sort of the distinction in terms of gender representation between the two plants is also something to notice, that proportionately more of the teaching stream is represented by women and proportionally more of the research stream represented by men. So there's also sort of some question, I think some, and I'm not the right gender to necessarily raise it, asking about a gender disparity here between the two plants and lack of representation on top of that. I think, you know, one of the things we could come out of on this meeting, and I hope maybe we can gain some agreement on, is at the very least, we should be saying there should be at least one trustee seat set aside for the teaching stream. So specifically out of those four seats, that one be from the teaching stream. And the second, that the teaching stream be allowed to vote in this process, which we currently can't. So we do have that issue there. Now, part of the issue is in the past, as I started to raise these questions at the annual general meeting, and this was the questions were normally answered by the chair of the trustee board. So whenever I've asked it, the response has always been, well, this can't really change. This is the way the agreements are set up. Now, at the most recent meeting that we had, the 2021, I think it was in April, the incoming chair, when I asked the question directly, what would it take to change the agreement, basically kind of said, well, if enough of the teaching stream, and I'm paraphrasing here, so I probably shouldn't have put this in quotes, but if enough of the teaching stream kind of made this an issue, something might, could happen. In part because I pointed out that the pension agreement, so our trustee agreement, so there's the trust plan for the money purchase, which is ours, there's the trust plan for the combination, which is the research stream. Both of them have an amendment clause in the plan document. And in both of them, the amendment clause reads the same way. And the agreement states that the pension board, which is that the eight trustees, may, with the written consent of the board of governors, basically make an amendment to that agreement. So as long as the Board of Governors give them written consent, they can amend that agreement. Be honest, I can't see why the Board of Governors would not give consent to amend for representation. So the only sort of qualifier was, I just added this, provided it doesn't impact the assets or change the contribution rates, so that they couldn't amend financial aspects. But they could amend, as far as I can read it, and I'm, you know, hey, if there's lawyers out there that can read this agreement and go, no, Chris, you haven't read it correctly, fill your boots. But the way I read it is that the plan can be amended by those eight trustees if the Board of Governors says, yes, you can amend it. And one of the amendments would be the representation. So I think that's where we're kind of left there. And I think, Sarah, I'm not sure in terms of our process now, what we want to do, let people ask questions, move on to the next thing. I sort of stayed within my 15 minutes or so. So you have
admirably stayed in your 15. We actually have 7 minutes, and I'm sorry, everyone. I sort of rushed in from another meeting, and I forgot to mention we were going to save questions at the end. But if there is any burning questions right now, actually for Chris, we do have 5 minutes. So if anybody has any questions, you can, you know, I can't really see you if you have your hand up. So if you could, in the chat, say you have a comment or a question. Or if you do put your hand up, you'll show up in my gallery. Tim?
Just a question for you, Chris, and I have to admit, I haven't looked at this in great detail, but from the sounds of things, what you said at the beginning, the Board of Governors appoints four individuals to the plan. Is it possible that that's another route that even though four members have to be, you know, are elected by and from members of the combination plan, if you put the pressure, could the university not appoint one of the money purchase plan members as one of their representatives? Just something to consider, that if they won't allow you to elect a member, yeah, could they, by pressure or whatever, be asked to appoint one?
So the it is the Board of Governors who appoints the four university trustees. So that might be another route. You're absolutely correct. Sorry, I was just checking that, but I've got all my files here. And it reads that the pension board shall consist of eight trustees, four of whom shall be appointed by the Board of Governors of the university, and four of whom shall be elected by and from the members of the plan. So yeah, that might be another route. If for some reason the Board of Trustees isn't willing to do that, and the Board of Governors is, I'd be surprised if the Board of Governors says, yes, you have our permission to change, that the Board of Trustees would stick their heels in, but who knows? So good point, Tim. Thank you.
I think Adam has a quick question. And after Adam's question, I wanted to, in our last, we have about, I am timing this. I'm really kind of sticky about this. Sorry. I'll try not to be too pedantic, but we got about 4.5 minutes left. And I'm wondering if there is a taste for a motion, an informal motion, to see if we should pursue the option of asking the Board of Governors to amend the pension document. And we will do that just to get to Adam's question, and then maybe we'll just see poll and see, or not poll, but go into the chat and see if people do have that interest in us moving forward with asking the Board of Governors to amend the pension document.
And Sarah, just to, because we have to be careful with the wording, give their permission or give their consent
to amend,
for the Board of Trustees to amend
the document. Yeah. Nathaniel, could we do a quick poll? Are you able to get that together? Or Penny, can somebody get that together? And Adam had a question here. Are there any laws relevant to representation on pension boards by plan members? Does anybody know? Or is that something we can look into? I have no idea. I'm completely out of my depth here.
I don't think there's anything in terms of sort of like, do you mean like civil law, civil statute about that?
Yeah, I mean, I did a quick Google. There seems to be a lot of provincial law about how pension plans work, but I have no idea if there would be anything in there about our members supposed to have representation on the pension board for their plan. I have no idea, but
good question. I don't know. Yeah.
So Nathaniel or Penny, are we able to get a poll together, or I didn't see an answer to that?
Hey, this is Nathan just popping in.
Nathan, sorry.
Yeah, no problem. There's a Nathan and a Nathaniel here now.
Oh, sorry. Okay. Hi, Nathan.
Hi. Yeah, so I'm not, polls need to be done kind of on the back end. It's usually done ahead of time. Penny might be able to do it right now, but if you wanted to do a motion of some sort, you could also, do it without a poll.
Okay, that's fine. So if everybody's, we can just do an informal motion that I was just given some wording here. As a direct message, would like the committee to pursue the option of asking the Board of Governors permission to amend the pension document. Okay, so we have, right. Yeah, okay, we could use the, you know what, let's do this in the Q&A, because we're going to move on. It's better to have more time in the Q&A. I'll figure out how to do this. And thanks to everyone who's been able to come thus far. I think representation on the pension board, by the way, somebody was mentioning that they'd rather join the defined benefit plan. then get representation. But that representation is, it should be for whatever plan we're in. Is that right, Chris? Like, it doesn't matter. We just need representation for our particular employment situation.
And I think that the which plan is a different question. Initially, I say just get representation because which plan, I think, is going to be a longer term discussion, whichever way we go with it. So whether you think we should be in the money purchase plan or the combination plan, regardless, we should have representation. So if we end up staying with a money purchase plan, we should have representation on the board. If we go to the combination plan, at some point in the future, then technically we would be members of that plan and we would be eligible to stand and eligible to vote. But I think that process, as probably will come out in the rest of the meeting, is going to be a much longer process if we decide to go that way than just simply asking for representation right now and perhaps being able to poke at the pension board a little bit about the differences between the two plans.
That's wonderful. Chris, thank you so much for this overview. I know that's our timer going off. So I'm going to move it over to Susan last, who's going to explain some of the terminology, which I need explained. This is probably my 15th to 20th time having this terminology explained, and I still need another explanation. For sure. So Susan's going to do that for us. And then we get Elizabeth, Google will be up. Elizabeth, I probably mispronounced your last name and I apologize. And no, then we've got our, sorry.
It's good. The last name was good, but correctly pronounced.
Thank you. It's a miracle, honestly. And then we have our presentations from our COUT representatives, Kyle Mueller, and Tim McGorman. I'd probably mispronounce that. And they can introduce themselves after. So this is our next 20 minutes or so, or actually our next 40 minutes or so. So first up is Susan Last. Thank you so much, Susan.
Thanks, Sarah. So I'm going to try to put in layman's terms or plain language that long report that we got. And sort of go through some of the terms, but basically compare the two plans so that we understand what the pros and cons are, because it's not super straightforward. And the pros and cons really depend on your personal circumstances and what you want to do when you retire and how you want to do estate planning and all kinds of things. But I'm going to just share my screen and go to this document, okay, so that I can sort of briefly go through the main points. I sort of condensed to one page, that 14-page document. And as Chris already went through the governance stuff, I won't go through that. But the members, so I broke this down because I'm in the money purchase plan. I'm a teaching stream faculty. I have the defined contribution plan. So these are all different terms used for the same thing. My partner has the defined benefit plan or the combined plan. He's not research faculty. He's in facilities management. So it's all sort of full-time employees, including research faculty, are in this plan. Whereas teaching professors, session instructors, and anybody who's part-time between 50 and 100% is on the money purchase plan. So research faculty can also be in this plan if they are part-time, like permanent part-time. So one of the key advantages to our plan, you know, I think of my plan versus my partner's plan. So my plan, the employer pays a little bit more every month, and I pay a little bit less every month into my plan than my partner does, right? He pays a little bit more into his plan, and the employer pays a little bit less into his plan every month. And overall, all things being equal, if we were hired at the same time, we worked the same number of years, we had the same salary, my pot would be a little bit bigger at the end of our, when we retired, right? So I'd have an advantage there in having just a bit more money in my pot. But there are advantages to the other one as well. And that's when you actually retire. So in my plan, I've got two options for retirement. Variable benefit, where whatever my pot is, we apply some kind of formula to and figure out how much I would get per month to make it last until I was 90, let's say. And then that's how much I would get paid. But that would also be dependent upon how well the stock market was doing or whatever I've got invested in. And it might crash, or I might do well, or I might live to be 110 and then I would run out of money. So things can happen here. I can also transfer it to an RRSP and have it managed that way. And that way I have a lot of flexibility because I can, you know, take out as much as I want every year in RSP. I can have a lot or a little. But the main advantage for my partner's plan is that he's got this internal variable annuity option, the IVA, which is the defined minimum benefit. So that means if his pot of money here at the end is, you know, below a certain threshold, the defined minimum benefit will top it up so that he will get a minimum amount every month, and it will be for as long as he lives. It will never run out. And another benefit of this is that it's indexed, so that you'll get a raise every year, right? And those raises are quite significant. Whereas my plan is not indexed, so when I run out of money, I just run out of money, and I don't get a raise every year. I just get what I get. So he's got the same two options that I have, right? But he also has this internal variable annuity option. So this is really, really a good thing for a lot of people, because it means that you get this amount of money every month. It will increase every year by a little bit, and it will never run out. You'll get it for as long as you live, right? And which is, you know, and you never have to think about it. You don't have to worry about investments. You don't have to worry about anything. The university or the employer carries all of the risk in terms of investment and longevity. So even if the market crashed, you would be safe, right? So the disadvantage here, though, is that if you passed away early, right? If you had an early death, if you have a spouse, well, your spouse can inherit your benefit. But if you don't have a spouse, the benefit is forfeited. So if you still had hundreds of thousands of dollars left in your pension, it would be forfeit. It would flow back into the plan, and it basically funds the IVA that way, right? So that's an issue if you are planning to, you know, have beneficiaries who are not your spouse. In my plan, I can make whoever I want the beneficiary. And if I passed away early and there was still a pot of money left that I hadn't used, it would go to my estate. So it would go to whoever I designated as my beneficiary. Could be my spouse, could be my kids, could be my best friend, whatever. So overall, if we just look at the overall pros and cons, right? Our plan has a slightly higher account balance at the end, all things being equal. If you pass away prematurely, you can designate your own beneficiary, and there's a lot more flexibility in annual payment. So if I wanted to have, like, say I want to retire and go traveling around the world, I can give myself a lot of money for the first couple of years out of my retirement, and then I can pay myself less every year after that. Whereas with the IVA, you can't. You just get what you get, and it's designated. So you can't draw more or less depending on, you know, if you want to do different things, buy a house or go traveling or whatever. The cons, though, is that in my plan, I assume all the investment risk, you know, what's going in the market or however I'm investing, I have to take that risk. I may not have the financial literacy to really invest it wisely or properly, planning for retirement. The retirement security and benefits are largely dependent on investment performance, right? So that's an issue. And there's a risk that for the employer, I guess, I might have to work longer to make sure that my pension is good. So, you know, I might not retire as early as I might, and it's hard to do staffing and stuff. So that's for the employer to think about. And the cons from my partner's plan is that there's no flexibility in annual income. And if the IVA is chosen, it doesn't pay out to non-spousal beneficiaries. Here's a little excerpt from the report that they sort of seem to think that the combination plan does provide overall better retirement benefits than the MP plan. But again, this is going to be really dependent on individual circumstances and history and what you plan to do when you retire and all that stuff. So it's not really an easy thing. The one other thing that I have to, I think, and I'm not sure I totally understand this idea, but I really want to try to explain it in clear terms. This defined benefit minimum kicks in and out at certain points. So let's say the pot of money that my partner has here is fairly small. And once the calculation is applied to it, his monthly income wouldn't quite meet the defined minimum. In this case, this would top up his benefit, right? So it would top it up. It would add to his benefit. And that would, you know, that'd be like, he'd be getting this huge benefit by getting a higher monthly amount because it will top it up. However, if his pot of money was really big, and once the benefit, like once that formula was applied, it exceeded the minimum defined benefit, then it wouldn't top him up. So he wouldn't get that benefit. Like he would be giving up some things to get this, and then he wouldn't actually get any benefit of it from it until his pot of money had gone down a little bit to where it no longer would reach that minimum on its own, and then it would get topped up again. So tell me, let me know if I'm wrong about that, Elizabeth or somebody, but that is my understanding of how that works. So the IVA, you know, you may switch this plan and still not get the benefit of the IVA if you have too much money or something like that. So I think that's all I have about explaining the main differences in the terms, and let me know if you have questions, but I might not be the best person to answer them.
Well, actually, Susan, you're right on time. And this is amazing. So Chris and Susan, I've never seen a meeting. Wow. Okay. So moving on. Have any questions? You can either put them in the chat and we'll try to get to them. But remember, we're recording so that if you want your question to be anonymous or not recorded, wait till the end. And we'll have quite a lengthy question and answer session. So now we'll just move over to Elizabeth. Thanks, Elizabeth.
Yeah, thank you. And Susan, no, I think you captured that idea very well. And thank you for explaining how the minimum benefit can come in and out. And as you said, if it's out, then actually, if you think about how much money there is that you're self-financing, you would actually have more in the other plan. But there is no flexibility in basically coming back to that minimum if funds are drawn down. Yeah. So I would like to talk about a different way in which teaching stream faculty can get a seat at a table, and that is through the joint committee of the administration of the agreement. Our president, Lynn Marks, raised the issue of the different types of plans that teaching stream faculty and research stream faculty have at that meeting. So this is something where usually we come together in order to just talk about issues that that pertain to the interpretation of the collective agreement. And so, you know, during COVID, there was also quite a bit of discussion in terms of accommodating all members of the bargaining unit and helping them cope with the stress that the pandemic put on us. Michelle Barkin is the Associate Vice President of Faculty Relations and Academic Administration. And so she is presenting the administration in that committee. When Lynn raised the issues around teaching stream faculty being put in a different plan than research stream faculty, she seemed open to further discuss this issue and look into it. And so what we were wondering is whether we can get volunteers from the teaching stream faculty who would be willing to be on that kind of subcommittee of our committee in order to look into these questions further. And yes, Lynn, please feel free to say something in connection to this.
Yeah, I'm just not 100% sure she's committed to a subcommittee. I've asked for it. She's committed to talking to us, but whether that just means talking to me or a longer term discussion, but I think she likely would be. So because she was concerned about this, and also, I mean, the gender inequity that Chris showed in that table really potentially puts them at risk. I'm not sure how far we would get legally. We would have to look into that, but the university doesn't want to look bad by doing this. I don't know. Also, Natalie asked how teaching stream faculty got put into the pension plan. I don't know if that's going to be raised or if I could give a very quick answer courtesy of Mark Laidlaw if you want.
That'd be great. Yeah.
Okay. What I was told is because early on, a lot of the earliest teaching stream faculty who were then called senior instructors had been sessional instructors. And so they had been in the money purchase plan pension. And so they stayed in that when they became teaching stream, and that was the pattern, but which doesn't mean it's not problematic, but that is the history of it.
If I could just add to this, I've also heard that at the beginning when there was sessionals, the idea of a defined minimum benefit was a little bit hard to conceptualize because of the different number of courses that sessionals would often teach. But as you know, teaching stream faculty is regularized, and so we do know what your services are at all times.
Okay, are you finished, Elizabeth?
Yes, I am. So basically, all we were trying to say here is that there's another channel where we are raising these issues, and if there are people who are interested, perhaps in that committee that Lynn was mentioning, then we would like to hear from you.
Yes, yeah. I want to reiterate what Chris said. I've been doing this union stuff for quite a while, and pension issues take quite a long time, but that doesn't mean we shouldn't pursue it. And it's really important for all of our members and everybody going forward, in my small opinion. And with that, let's go to other people who know a lot more than me. So to our Kaut presenters, and thanks.
Thank you, Sarah. So I'm going to share my screen here. Hopefully everybody can see the report that we produced. I'm sure most of you have gone through it and read it. My name is Kyle Mayer. I'm here with my colleague, Tim McGorman. We are both actuaries from Element Consulting Group, and we are located in Winnipeg. I want to do my best to stay on schedule today. I don't want to get in Sarah's bad book, so I'm going to go ahead and jump into our report. I want to walk you through the report and really build off of the information that Susan provided earlier and summarize our key findings and opinions as it pertains to the money purchase pension plan and the combination pension plan that your faculty members participate in with the University of Victoria. And then Tim may also jump in and provide additional color in certain areas as we go through. And we'll both be available at the end to field any questions after the presentation. Our analysis and the opinions that we provided are intended to provide insight into the alternative plan designs and structures on a general basis. Our opinions do not consider specific financial situations or retirement goals of individual members. But that being said, we believe that our opinion would form the basis for majority of the members and general be accepted across the retirement community. Tim and I intend to highlight specific differences and costs in the two programs and discuss potential inequities created due to these differences. Given this information and your specific knowledge of the members in these groups and specifically in the money purchase plan, you should be able to answer the following question afterwards. And it's really, if the member had a choice between the money purchase plan and the combination plan, which would they choose? And so we'll come back to that afterwards. So I'm going to flip forward to do what I think is a bit repetitive of Susan, but really important, an overview of defined benefit and defined contribution pension plan. So when we look at a DC pension plan, they operate very similar to an RSP. The member and employer make contributions to the DC pension plan at a contribution rate specified in the plan document. And we'll go over those specific to both of those plans further on here. Those contributions earn investment income, and together the contributions and any investment income from the DC account balance are available for the member at retirement. This phase would be referred to the accumulation phase. Once the member retires, they begin drawing an income from that account balance, and the remaining monies in the DC account continue to earn investment income throughout their retirement. And so this is referred to as the decumulation phase. Under this type of program, the employer transfers all the risks to the member. Now, this includes investment risk and longevity risk in the accumulation phase and the decumulation phase. There's the possibility to pool some of that risk among the other members. So that's what happens during the accumulation phase in the money purchase plan. All the assets are pooled together and there's professionals who manage those assets, but there's still a risk that those managers don't perform well and that there isn't the investment income that the member would be looking for. The member is fully responsible for determining what the magic value of their account balance that will allow them to have a retirement income for the remainder of their lifetime. So this is a very difficult question, and honestly will be different for each member. With so many unknowns into the future, you know, how will my investment choices perform? Will I live to 100? Will I only live to 75? Are all questions that the member will have to ask themselves and really have no concrete answer for. So this makes planning for retirement very difficult and stressful. And once in retirement, it can create unnecessary stress, especially for members that are not financially literate. When we look at a DB pension plan, the structure is very different to that of a DC pension plan. The contributions remitted to the plan are pooled and they form part of the defined benefit assets and do not form part of the DB benefit that the member is going to get at retirement. The DB benefit, the defined benefit, is based on a defined formula, which is laid out in the plan text, and is typically linked to members' earnings and service with the employer. So this benefit is paid to a member at retirement for the remainder of their lifetime, and if they have a spouse, would be paid or provided to their spouse upon their death. Okay. So in the event that the assets are insufficient to fund the benefits promised under the plan, under a defined benefit plan, the employer would be required to contribute more. So the risk rests fully with the employer under a defined benefit structure. In the event that future experience does not match the assumptions used by the actuary to determine the costs under those DB plans, there's going to be gains or losses. And those DB pension plans are typically very expensive. And for this reason, we don't see many DB pension plans outside of the public sector anymore. Under this type of plan design, the member has no worries about outliving their retirement account balance or about the performance of their investments, as the promise is backed by the employer. The member receives a steady income stream until their death with no required oversight. And this security is typically very much welcomed by retirees. So I'm sure most of you are aware, I'm going to get into the specifics now of the money purchase plan and the combination plan. The money purchase plan is really a defined contribution pension plan. And the combination plan has both components. It has a DC component and it has a DB component. And so now that we've formed the baseline, I'm just going to scroll down to our conclusion. I'm going to start with our findings and our opinion, and then we'll go through some of the details of our report. So the members in the contribution plan, in our opinion, have a clear advantage to those members in the money purchase plan. And this advantage stems from the retirement option of an internal variable annuity. And the internal variable annuity provides for the better of the defined benefit minimum index that changes in the consumer price index annually, which we'll get into a little bit more detail on, and the adjusted combination account balance. So the DC component at retirement gets adjusted for investment experience relative to 3.5% and longevity experience under the plan. And so the larger of those two amounts annually, as Susan said, provides the stream of pension into the future under the combination plan. Okay. Through the internal variable annuity, the member is provided with that floor or the base stream of income that is increased each year with inflation. Plus they receive upside advantage of good investment and longevity experience under the plan. So because they get the better of the two, the defined benefit minimum indexed each year for inflation, or their DC account based on the investment experience that that has, they really have the full upside of both benefits. So they have the upside of a defined benefit plan and the upside of a defined contribution plan. The only difference is that the member doesn't have the same flexibility that a defined contribution member would have. You know, they may want to start withdrawing more money when they're younger and taper that down as they get older. They don't have that flexibility under the combination plan. But unless they really feel that they're going to outperform the professionals who have investment strategies and manage the money under the combination plan, and they don't really need the flexibility, there's really no reason that they wouldn't choose the internal variable annuity. And so this is something that we didn't have access to, but having the full information on how many of the members actually choose the internal variable annuity at retirement would be very helpful when reviewing our analysis or in conjunction with our analysis and our report here today. So I'm going to start with what I feel are the two main differences under the plans. One is the contributions that are remitted to the plan from both members and the university. And the second is the retirement benefits. And we touched on it, the internal variable annuity, very attractive benefit to have for the membership. When we look at the contributions, the members under the combination plan remit 1% more than members under the money purchase plan. And under the, and I'm talking the defined contribution component right now. And under the money purchase plan, the university contributes 2% more above and below the YMP. So this results in 1% more of earnings going towards the DC component of the money purchase plan than the combination plan.
And Kyle, could you make your screen a little bit, the page a bit bigger so we could read it a bit easier? Thanks.
Yeah. Is that better? Perfect. And so the table lays out the totals here. And so we can see in the top half of the table here, the top two thirds of the table, the totals under the money purchase plan, which is the defined contribution component, are 1% higher than under the combination plan. So all else being equal, if the member knows from the outset, you know, that they're going to take the DC money, they're going to transfer it, or they're going to take the variable annuity, the money purchase plan is advantageous because their account balance is going to be higher. Their DC account balance is going to be higher under the money purchase plan than under the combination plan. If they're not intending to take the DC component and they're intending to go to retirement and elect the internal variable annuity, the combination plan is significantly more advantageous. And we can see that because the university remits 2% more in total. 2% more of earnings goes towards the combination plan than the money purchase plan when we look at both the DC component and the DB component. And so we could see here in the middle row, it says defined benefit retirement account. We see the university only, and this is 4%. So on top of the defined contribution account that's being contributed to, the university contributes an additional 4% that goes strictly to the internal variable annuity component and to fund that. And the reason that that's there and is required to be funded is because defined benefit promises are expensive, and the assets, there need to be more assets there to back those promises into the future. Because we know if the contribution rate isn't sufficient and the assets aren't sufficient to provide for that promised defined benefit minimum, the university has the responsibility to fund that deficit. So if the liabilities under the defined benefit plan, the defined benefit component of the contribution plan, combination plan, are below above the assets that are available for that plan, there's going to be a deficit, and that deficit has to be funded by the university. So what we can see and what we've been provided with here are the contribution rates going into the plan. So we know right off the bat, there's more money going into the combination plan for members of that plan than under the money purchase plan, 2% total earnings. On top of that, if we got past actuarial evaluation reports, we may see that the university has also made what's called special payments or additional lump sum contributions to the defined benefit component of the combination plan to fund past deficits. So what we have here is we know for sure they're putting more in into the future, 2% more of earnings. There may also have been additional lump sum payments put in the past to fund any deficit, because these programs are expensive and it would be typical to see a deficit under a defined benefit plan at some point over its history. The second portion I wanted to point out is the retirement benefits. So under the combination plan, the retirement benefits are identical to the money purchase plan with the addition of the internal variable annuity, as we discussed. And so again, the internal variable annuity provides the greater of the defined benefit minimum indexed annually at changes in CPI and the variable benefit provided by the DC component. The defined benefit minimum portion is a benefit based on 1.3% of the member's final 5-year average pensionable earnings before retirement up to the yearly maximum pensionable earnings plus 2% above the yearly maximum pensionable earnings times a year of service. So this is the connection that I was talking about earlier to the salary, the member's salary, and the member's years of service under the plan. There's no connection to the defined benefit component to the contributions being remitted. Okay, that defined benefit minimum sets the floor. Under the combination plan, members who elect the internal variable annuity can never get less than that defined benefit minimum. And that defined benefit minimum will never decrease. It could only increase for changes in inflation. And it's capped each year between 0 and 3%. So in any year, if inflation is negative, they'll never decrease that defined benefit minimum, but they'll bring that negative amount forward. So it's a cumulative into the future. And if inflation is above 3%, they will grant 3% in that year. And anything above the 3% will go to the next to apply for the next year. Okay. So that's the defined benefit minimum. It's a very, very advantageous benefit. It's very rare to see a defined benefit plan indexed at the full change in CPI annually. Inflation risk is very expensive into the future because it's unknown. And so, as we know, governments have been spending unprecedentedly lately, and there's a good chance that inflation is going to go up. And so these people who have that protection that their monthly pension stream is going to be increased to meet the change in the consumer price index on an annual basis is very attractive, and it's a very expensive benefit to provide. The other portion of the internal variable annuity, as I mentioned, is the variable benefit. And so the variable benefit is really created by the defined contribution, the DC component in the combination plan. And that's the contributions that were going to that piece. Those form what they would convert into an annuity. And then that annuity based on a set of rates set by the actuary. And that annuity is based on a 3.5% expected return into the future. If the investments under the combination plan earn more than 3.5%, then they're going to increase that variable benefit. If they earn less than 3.5%, they're going to decrease that variable benefit. And then the variable benefit's also going to be increased or decreased for changes in the longevity of the group. So the longevity is pooled under the combination plan as well as the money purchase plan if you choose that benefit. So you get the better of the two. Well, how does that look? What if we try and quantify that? And so we go to our table here. And so what we did is we looked at one scenario, you know, based on a tenure of 25 years and a 6% interest or average interest rate or average investment income over the life, that lifetime, over that 25 years. We looked at what the defined benefit minimum would be. And then we compared that to the variable benefit. And so we could see here, this individual retired at age 65. And based on their earnings and the 6% investment returns over the period, the defined benefit minimum would be $43,300 to begin with. So that's the base floor based on their earnings, their final average five earnings, pensionable earnings, and the service under the plan, 25 years. The defined benefit minimum would provide for $43,300 annually at onset of retirement. That amount's increased annually. We assumed inflation was going to be 2%. So it's increased annually at 2% into the future indefinitely. And so we could see after, once the individual reaches age 90, that amount has grown to $71,100. What does the variable benefit now look like under the money purchase plan and the combination plan? Well, under the combination plan, because we know the DC component is less, there's less contributions coming in, the account balance is going to be less at retirement, it provides for a smaller variable benefit. But we could still see it's well below the defined benefit minimum, even at 6% average return over 20 years. And it's only slightly under below the money purchase plan expected variable benefit. And so each year, the variable benefits compared to the defined benefit minimum, and we can see there's relatively no change until the account balance runs out at age 90. So in this scenario, if this individual lived beyond age 90, their defined contribution variable benefit would run out. They would have no money left in the account. Whereas the individual under the defined benefit minimum would still be collecting $72,500 into the future. And so that's a significant advantage. And I've had some conversations with Elizabeth about alternative scenarios. We can definitely provide alternative scenarios for someone who has a tenure of 30 years, 35 years, different salary expectations. There's going to be an infinite number of scenarios that we can look at. But you would really have to have stellar investment performance for the variable benefit to be greater than the defined benefit minimum indexed at full changes in CPI into the future. Is really the bottom line opinion of when we looked at the comparison between these two plans. There's a significant disparity, a noticeable difference between that defined benefit minimum and the DC component provided by the combination plan or the money purchase plan. And so that cost, you know, we look at the cost of those, that present value. If we present value that future stream, there would be a liability and you have to back that liability by an asset. That cost is being funded by the additional 4% going into the defined benefit retirement account, plus any experience on the membership. In the event that those contributions are unable to fund that promise, the university will have to kick in additional money, which is called special payments. And we could, if we had prior actuarial valuation reports, we'd be able to tell you whether or not the university had to or hadn't put in additional contributions above the set contribution rate in the past. And so one last thing I just want to quickly touch on before we move on with the program. I think I got a minute here, maybe two, is the post-retirement death benefits. And so 5 minutes, perfect. Don't know if I'll need it, but the post-retirement death benefit under the money purchase plan, as Susan mentioned, if the member dies, whatever's left over in their account goes to the spouse or the beneficiary. It's very simple. Under the combination plan, if they choose the variable benefit or they transfer it to a RIF or a LIF, same thing as the money purchase plan. Anything left over at the end of the day goes to the member's estate, beneficiary, spouse. Under the internal variable annuity, it depends on the type of optional form of payment that the member elected at retirement. And so there's a number of different optional forms. Under the plan, it only provides life only as the base benefit. And then all other benefits are actuarial equivalent to that base benefit. So the plan provides for the payment stream to the member's life only. And when the member dies, the payment stream would end. There are a number of different optional forms that the member can choose. If there is a spouse, typically they have to choose a joint survivor type of option, unless the spouse signs a waiver. So there's protection for the spouse. If they don't have a spouse, they can choose a guarantee period. They can choose the payment stream to be guaranteed for 5 years, 10 years, or 15 years. And so there is protection to the member. In the case that they die prematurely, there will be a remaining guarantee. So if they choose the life guaranteed for 15 years and they pass away after 5, their named beneficiaries will get the additional 10 years of payments. So there is some protection for premature death there. Under the joint survivor options, if they choose the joint survivor 100%, that means when the member dies, 100% of the payments continue to their spouse until their spouse passes away. There are other joint survivor options, such as joint survivor two-thirds, where if the member passes away, two-thirds of the pension is paid to their spouse for the remainder of their lifetime. And so that's a really important function of defined benefit plans, because there's that spousal security, and there is a way to protect from premature death to ensure that the member still gets a reasonable amount of payments than they otherwise wouldn't have if they choose the life-only option. And so those additional options that are chosen are actuarial equivalent. So if you're going to get $1,000 on a life-only basis, you might only get $800 on a joint survivor 100% basis into the future, or something of that sort. So you're going to get a lower amount, but that amount is expected to be paid out longer. So it's a security built in to the benefit payments. Under the defined benefit assumptions that are used, the actuary is going to make an assumption on mortality. So some people are going to assume to die early. Some people are assumed to live to 100. It's all going to work out to an average at the end of the day. And so there, when you pool the longevity, you have that ability to provide everybody with the payment for the rest of their life, but you take gains and losses from different people. So somebody might gain where another person might lose. That's another important aspect of a defined benefit program. So I said a lot there. I'm going to pause there and pass it back to Sarah, and we could discuss any questions that you may have when we come to that.
Thanks so much, Kyle. And there's just been a rolling commentary in the chat, which has been really useful. At this point, before we take any questions, Penny, we did get a poll together, and we have a motion that we'd like to put forward since the attendance is so high. And Penny, are you ready for the poll? It's just a yes, no. Okay, here we go. So I don't sure how much time we need here, but okay.
I can't seem to vote, but I would vote yes.
Yeah, I can't seem to vote either, but that's fine because we've reached, I think we get the answer. No, so, yeah, so we're going to.
I think it's something about being a host, you can't vote, is that right?
Okay, I'm a yes. I want representation on that board. So that's my personal vote. Okay, so I think we can end the poll. So I just, anybody can click end there, and we will move forward with that and share information with the teaching faculty membership from down the line or very shortly. Okay, so I guess the questions are open, and Chris has made a